Good morning, and welcome to a brand new episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, broadcasting from the Microsoft campus in Redmond, Washington. Ooh. I got up at 6 a.m. and drove all the way in here, so I wouldn't have to worry about the shuttle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So, today is an exciting day. We've got a new locale for me, anyway, and we're going to be talking about battles and death, of course. And that's really what The Hobbit's about, right?
In fact, exactly.
Tolkien tells us that's what all good literature is about, mortality.
Mortality.
And death. Yeah.
Exactly.
So anyway, let's get started. With me, as always, are my co-hosts, the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, and Trish Lambert. Good morning, you two.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning. So, so today we're going to talk about death. Well, you know, we've been joking about this because we've been sort of leading up to this for a long time. It's been, I don't know how many weeks that we, you know, have been sort of making reference to the, you know, oh, I think this person's going to die. And we keep saying, oh, no, let's save it. We got to wait until we get. Well, today is the day when we're finally going to talk about the outcomes of the Battle of Five Armies. We talked about the setup for the Battle of Five Armies last time and how it's going to come about and how it's going to begin and how the sort of tension and disagreements and misunderstandings that come before, which we've been discussing for a while now, are going to erupt into actual battle and how the orcs are going to come in. And now today we want to talk about the actual flow of the battle. I would like to start off by thinking about the sort of reminding us about the shape of this. Because of course we were just joking about, you know, like, oh yeah, The Hobbit, of course, is all about death. And you know, this is something that I think that people, it's a little kind of objection that I've found myself wanting to make all along, especially when people have been, you know, in particular, of course, when the first film came out, and people, you know, people who haven't been obsessively speculating about this for years, you know, were sort of responding to the film and saying, you know, oh, but like the Hobbit is a lighthearted children's book. It's not, you know, it's just not at all like this. It's not like the, you know, the way that the film has been depicting this great epic thing. Well, yes and no. Yes, of the beginning of the book. No, of the end of the book. And it's one of the really striking things that always, I think, really affects attentive readers when they read The Hobbit for the first time is the shift in tone. It's a very perceptible shift in tone from the beginning of the book to the end. The Hobbit really does grow up as we go along. And I mean, if you notice, the body count at the end of The Hobbit is higher than the body count at the end of The Lord of the Rings. I mean, we lose more major characters in The Hobbit than we lose in The Lord of the Rings. I think a very, something not to be underestimated, because clearly one of the things, one of the choices that Tolkien made, which is an unusual and kind of unexpected choice in some ways, is that he takes this children's book, which he has been very consciously designing for children all along, and I do not think, again, one possible way of interpreting it, one interpretation some people have done, is to say that basically The Hobbit kind of leaves children behind, and it's not really so much a children's book by the end. And I disagree with that. I think that, like, what Tolkien is doing is basically sort of taking children and bringing them into contact with these other things. We know from the writing that he did in On Fairy Stories, for instance, when he talked about children and children's stories, is that he was very much opposed to the idea of children being sheltered. You know, he didn't like the ways in which so many modern editors, and by modern editors, of course, he would have meant late Victorian, you know, and early 20th century editors, who were like, you know, expurgating traditional fairy stories and stuff and wanting to remove, and he was criticizing Andrew Lang for this, you know, Andrew Lang's great fairy story collections, you know, Andrew Lang being not exactly to England what the Brothers Grimm were to Germany, of course, as his process was totally different. But basically, Andrew Lang was the primary transmitter of fairy tales into English, you know, in the 19th and into the 20th century. And yet, Tolkien objected to the way that he cleaned them up. So many of them he cleaned up. And he removed the more gruesome bits, and he Andrew Lang himself, again, quoting referring to a part of Tolkien's commentary in On Fairy Stories, instead of killing off the villains at the end, instead of the villains sort of, you know, receiving, death and or some other form of punishment, Andrew Lang would, sort of joked about how he would instead just sort of like send them off into retirement with a comfortable pension instead. And Tolkien hated that. You know, he said that he thinks that, that he didn't think children like that. And he certainly didn't think that children had to be protected from this idea of, you know, the harsh realities of life. Stories are one of the means by which children begin to be able to understand and process what the world is like. It's interesting, in fact, that essentially his argument is that in many ways, for children, fairy tales are the opposite of escapist. They are the way in which they are acculturated into the real world, into the adult world, that they play a really important role in that, or can or should play a really important role in that. And I think that that's what we can see happening in The Hobbit at the end. The passage, and I mentioned this in my book, but the passage that always particularly strikes me about this is his description of the suffering of the people of Lake Town, not just how sad they were and how difficult and uncomfortable it was the morning after Smaug's attack, when they're all huddling on the shores of the lake and mourning the dead, but that he, in fact, goes on to explain the suffering and mortality that's going to be among them in the coming winter, to really paint a picture for the readers. Here's the really very awful situation. And it's not just like, and this is threatened, if nothing good happens, they might have a really hard time. He tells us the future, he says many of them will die over the winter. That's going to happen. And I think that's a really important choice, I think, for Tolkien. And it's something to really to not lose sight of when thinking about the Hobbit book, is that the Hobbit book is not it's certainly, I'm not trying to say that the sort of the thematic emphases and the way that Peter Jackson has been handling violence and death and things like that are in the same spirit that Tolkien is doing it. But certainly the way that sometimes people talk about The Hobbit in contrast to Peter Jackson's films sounds to me way too naive, way too simplistic. The Hobbit doesn't do that. The death scene of Thorin, we're going to talk about Thorin's actual deathbed scene and look at the end of Thorin's trajectory in our next episode. But the fact that Thorin dies and the deathbed scene that he has with Bilbo, this is one of the most remarkable and one of the most moving moments in any work of children's literature that I know. It's a really striking thing. So that's just, I think, an important context for us to recall as we think about the battle and we think about the death toll and the outcomes of the battle and everything. Is that here, the Hobbit book has really drawn closer to the trajectory that the film has been on all along at this time. I feel like the gap in some ways between the book and the film is much narrower here at the end than at the beginning.
Are you talking about gap in terms of tone?
Yeah, primarily in terms of tone.
You're talking about sort of like the sense in which people say, like, oh, the Hobbit's a children's book, but the films are... but Jackson's altering the films and making them into the epic tone or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. No, I've always felt that way. I'll be honest with you. My enjoyment of the book increases as we approach the end. My favorite chapters are the last ones, where it's less fairy tale-ish, more feels a little more epic in tone. I like those last few chapters. I like the description of the battle, but I am particularly like sort of the aftermath of the battle.
Yeah, it's really quite wrong. I mean, you think of all of the choices that Tolkien doesn't make, mm-hmm. He has so many opportunities. His own story presents him with many opportunities to clean it up. You know, there are several happy endings just waiting for him. I mean, they're right there. Bilbo's attempt could succeed. You know, Bilbo, you know, everything looks like it's going downhill fast. Bilbo does this noble, courageous, humble thing, self-sacrificing thing of surrendering the Arkenstone. He's trying to establish peace. How hard would it be to allow peace to be established? And then everyone's like, thanks, Bilbo. If it weren't for you, a terrible battle would have happened. But because you were noble and self-sacrificing, you, like, you know, averted all of this bloodshed, and now everyone's happy and we owe it all to Bilbo. That, in fact, would in some ways seem like almost a more appropriate thing. Like, because then he would legitimately be the hero. Notice how he's been the hero of the story all along. And then, I was going to say, he vanishes at the end. Of course, that's literally true. He does vanish at the end. But that's, you know, he doesn't in fact play a major role at the end of the story. It's and, you know, and again, so you would think in some ways you could say even sort of the narrative drive of the story would suggest that Bilbo's culminating action be the climax of the story, right? But it doesn't happen. He doesn't avoid the battle. Despite his attempts, he does everything. Bilbo does everything right. He does everything that he could have done, and yet the battle happens anyway. You know, you could have had Thorin's final charge could have succeeded, right? You know, we could have had the so the goblins show up, but then Thorin charges out, and it looks like here's the Eucatastrophe we've been waiting for, right? Thorin charges down, and he rallies the people, and so this is like the final culminating moment of the renewed, alliances between the dwarves and the elves and the men, and everyone rallies around Thorin, and he's gotten better, right? He's repented of his evil ways, and now he's like become a true self-sacrificing leader, and everyone loves him, and everybody's happy, and they beat the goblins, and the end. That's a good ending too. And it's right there, right? I mean, that's the point. When I was a kid, that's the point that always crushed me, that Thorin's dramatic charge didn't succeed. If I had had The Hobbit to rewrite when I was 9, that's how I would have rewritten it. It's absolutely how I would have rewritten it. I've always loved, and this is also why, you know, like how you can tell that unlike, you know, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, I did not grow up immersed in the Northern point of view, right? Because to me, the great, you know, the most exciting and heroic act is not the desperate
is dying
and failed defense, right? You know, the sacrifice, you know, the surrendering your life nobly and taking many of them with you as the house burns down around you, but rather the, like, you know, the charge that this is why the Eucatastrophe on the Battle of Pelennor Field brings tears to my eyes literally every time I read it. The arrival, the unexpected, miraculous arrival of Aragorn on the battlefield, turning the tide of the battle, and Amir and the Rohirrim not dying and everything. That's the scene that always affected me most, and the charge of the Rohirrim.
You are a Eucatastrophe junkie.
Oh, absolutely! I am completely a Eucatastrophe junkie. You can't. This is. It's actually. I think it's one of the reasons why I have to confess to not just intellectual disagreement, but like personal annoyance with people who complain about Eucatastrophe and just want to write it off as like a facile Deus Ex Machina ending. Because, man, right. There can't be enough Eucatastrophe for me. Tolkien could bring the eagles in twice as often as he does, and I'd be happy.
And you'd be a happy,
you know,
guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely. To me, there can be no superfluity of Eucatastrophe as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, so, you know, but Dave, again, back to your point. But he keeps not doing this, right? I mean, there are a number of ways he could have brought a cheerful, happy ending, but instead he does. Instead, he goes the tragic route, and it's deeply moving. And again, I find it really quite remarkable. But anyway, Yeah, yeah.
Bruce... When he does that yeah thing, by the way, everybody, that's because he's reading your questions.
Yeah, yeah, that's also true. I say it a lot anyway, but yes. Yes. Bruce says, why do you think Tolkien chose to take Bilbo out of the final battle?
I have an idea about that.
Yeah, let's hear.
I just tend to think, I was thinking about this the other day, as a matter of fact, Bruce, it's interesting you bring it up, because I thought, I just think he felt it was too problematic to try to deal with in writing. In other words, it was more convenient to kind of have Bilbo conk out and then get the report of the five battle post recover, you know, after he comes to consciousness again, because it could be more of a summary overview of the battle as opposed to writing the entire battle, you know, item by item by item by item, like a Helm's Deep type thing. You know, he hadn't really done that yet, and I just thought to myself, it seems to me like probably Bilbo got conked and, you know, passed out as a way of sort of not having to go into that much detail in writing.
So you're going with the didn't want to write the battle explanation?
That's what I'm trying not to say it quite in those words, but yes.
Well, I mean, because here is, I mean, one thing about that, of course, it's one thing to bring these kinds of things to kids, you know, in a children's book. And again, it's not like he spares the gruesome image of the vampire bats, sucking the blood from the corpses on the battlefield is like sufficiently gruesome. I mean, that
Ger Martin would have a, that's what I'm calling him that now. Ger Martin. Yeah. That's the kind of stuff he loves to write.
Right.
Yeah. I was just imagining what would the G.R.R. Martin, what would that look like, his version of this story?
And actually, sadly, there are a lot of writers that would love to, you know, they would really get into writing the gory details of
exactly.
that. But you're absolutely right. I can't imagine Tolkien even wanting to write that stuff.
Exactly. I mean, because there's a difference between basically confronting children with the battle, even inviting them to imagine it, but he leaves that to their... He doesn't... And actually, you know, Trish, you're thinking about George R. R. Martin here. Is I'm pausing because I'm wanting to be careful about saying this. There are a couple different approaches that you can take as a writer, right? One is to... It depends on the degree of freedom that you are leaving the imagination of your readers, right? For some people, they kind of will lead you to a thing, and they'll kind of leave you to fill in a lot of the details on your own. And with some, they will take you through every detail. And
some people will drown you in those details.
Exactly. And honestly...
We're not naming any names.
Right. It's one of my negative reactions to George R.R. Martin. To his stories. I should not, shouldn't make it personal to him. I've never met him, and so don't have any personal reactions to him. But one of my reactions to reading his stories is because of the things that he describes and the ways in which he describes them, he is compelling me to go places where I don't want to go. I find it exhausting to go. And it's one of the reasons why I can't get...
He forces it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I am compelled... If I'm going to read the story, I am compelled to go down these directions. And you can... I mean, I'm not saying that's not a defensible approach. But it's why I find his books so unpleasant to read. I don't enjoy reading them.
I think also...
I admire them, but I don't enjoy them for that reason.
And I do, but I do also think that, and I'm going to, I'm hopefully speaking for you, Corey, because I think we may share this. I'm not against, you know, blood and guts. I mean, it's not like I'm not going to read any book that has blood and guts. For example, huge Dresden Files fan. And Butcher gets, you know, there's some liquid, messy, sticky scenes in the Dresden Files stories.
Absolutely.
I don't have a problem with that.
Me
I guess, neither. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's because the story itself is... you got to have those scenes for the story to proceed, but I don't ever feel like he's taking me as far as Martin.
No, I agree. And to me, the difference is, it's not just what is described, right? It's not even just about the level of description. What Martin does, and he does it really compellingly, you know, as I've said many times before, what I dislike about George R.R. Martin is not a reflection of the ways in which his story is failing. It's a reflection of the way in which his story is succeeding. If his stories were less well written and succeeded less well, I wouldn't dislike them as much as I do. I mean, I would enjoy them more. Maybe, I don't know. But basically, because he does such a compelling job of bringing me into the mindset of appalling people. You know, like I am sort of compelled in my imagination. I am compelled to invest my imagination in the outlook and mentality of people whose outlooks and mentalities I find absolutely repulsive. Yeah. That I find the experience so completely exhausting. Now, but I don't want to go too far down this tangent. But this is to say, what Tolkien does in The Hobbit, and frankly, what Tolkien does most of the time, is a totally different kind of approach. And the one of the reasons for this, and I was thinking of this, I occasionally do this where I like randomly answer a fan email I've gotten on a totally different subject some time ago in the middle of an arbitrary episode where they're unlikely ever to hear it. But I forget who it was. I can't even remember who it was now. It might even be one of our listeners here who emailed me with a quotation from George R.R. Martin, who was saying that Tolkien's stories are just basically not realistic enough for him. And in particular, what he was citing were the problems of kingship and rulership. You know, that like in The Lord of the Rings, Aragorn becomes king and like sets everything to rights, and like the whole country becomes like a good and benevolent place because he's a good and benevolent king. And George R. R. Martin was saying, that's not realistic. Like, to be a ruler, you have to make really hard decisions. And like the political realities of real life force people, you know, so basically he was saying that in his stories, what he is doing is showing, you know, real complicated human beings trying to deal with, you know, and like they don't always make choices, you know, choices everybody would applaud, but they don't always have the best options. And, you know, so they're, you know, many of them are trying to do the best they can, but they're still doing awful things because that's what happens in the real world. This was Martin's argument as it was being transmitted to me here by this listener. You were reading that interview too?
Yeah, I read that same interview.
My primary response to that is that what I think George R. R. Martin is not considering there is that Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings is in a different genre entirely. It's just a fundamentally different kind of story. The fact that, you know, Aragorn's right. kingship is not being depicted in a way which George R. R. Martin considers realistic is not, you know, a failure of Tolkien's imagination. Neither The Lord of the Rings nor The Hobbit are novels in the strict generic sense. The novel, which has its origin back in the 18th century, that the novel, which was, which basically starts with Robinson Crusoe, right? And the idea, and Pamela, I don't want to leave Richardson out of it. We got Samuel Richardson's Pamela and Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, both of which are claiming to be the reports of an actual person. So again, the whole kind of conceit of the novel is that it's something that happens, A, in our modern world, and B, in the real world, right? That these are supposed to be just a fictional account of something that's happening in the real world. In fact, many people who read Robinson Crusoe thought it was a true story. I mean, they had sort of defense against that. There was no established convention that prompted them to read this as fiction. You know, because in fact, that was the whole point of the novel, is that it was aping reality in that way. The fairy tale tradition, the epic tradition, all of these other kinds of stories, they're not inferior stories. This is one of the things that really annoys me about a lot of modern readers, because the novel has been the dominant mode for so long that everybody assumes it's like the mode of storytelling. And that if somebody tells a story in a different mode, if somebody tells a myth or a fairy tale or an epic or an allegory or any of the other kinds of stories that are even a more traditional romance, And I don't mean romance in the modern sense. I mean romance in the medieval sense. If someone is trying to tell a story in any of those other kinds of genres, people will just basically evaluate it as if it's a novel and be like, yeah, really, it was kind of lackluster because it doesn't do all the things that I expect out of a novel. Dude, it wasn't trying to do those things. It's doing something entirely different. And that's basically my answer to George R. R. Martin's objection about the realism of Tolkien. On a very different level, it's very realistic, but it's not interested in the kind of storytelling that he's interested in. And that's fine, you know, different strokes and everything. It's all good.
Right.
But it's just a silly way to do that. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Tom Hillman, I think, makes a really good point. He says one of the main differences, and this, see if this kind of says what you've kind of been pointing to. One of the main differences between Tolkien and Martin is that Tolkien's fantasy is based on the literature of the Middle Ages, and Martin's is based on the history of the Middle Ages.
That is a really interesting distinction. I mean, I think that there are other... to me, there's a fundamental framework difference. I mean, a lot of the difference... I do agree with that. I think that's true.
I also think, you know, Andrew McLaughlin kind of says this too, which is many of the writers that come after Tolkien in terms of fantasy writers, I think Martin seems to be one of these. It's like they want to correct how Tolkien's approach. It's like for them, for some reason, the way Tolkien approached it is, you know, I want to do it, you know, I'm going to improve on Tolkien's approach, which in their, you know, in Martin's mind, I guess what he's doing is doing that. And I think it's more what you said, which is just a different genre. It's just a different genre.
It is.
I call Martin's military fantasy. And actually, mm-hmm. somebody in the Tolkien Society Facebook page, we were having a conversation about this the other day, and somebody said, Isn't Martin just history, like, you know, with fantasy thrown into it? You know, he's like, he's doing kind of a middle-aged, you know, history of the Middle Ages with a fantasy component. Well, that's an interesting way of thinking of it, actually.
Sort of. I mean, I do think it's much more fundamentally world-building than that. I mean, like, I've heard arguments, you know, that are sort of trying to say that, you know, the Game of Thrones is essentially an allegory of the Wars of the Roses.
Oh,
not exactly. I mean, it's not like, you know, really, you don't need to study the Wars of the Roses. Just read, you know, Song of Ice and Fire and you'll have it. I mean, no, it's not like that. I mean, it's certainly not as rigid as that. Certainly there are many ideas that he's drawn from it and even many sort of episodes or concepts that he's adapting from, you know, like based on a true story. But it's he's mining it for material, but it's not like it's an allegory of the War of the Roses.
I mean, I remember Edison, who was a contemporary of Tolkien's, wasn't
yes,
he? And the
yes.
worm, if I'm saying it right, the worm Ouroboros or
Ouroboros, yeah, I think, yeah.
It's one of those that I didn't ever know how to pronounce when I was younger, and then of course
right.
I'm doing it
right.
It was very much a similar sort of, you know, castle intrigue, military fantasy, factions, that kind of thing, if I'm recalling correctly. And that was written back in Tolkien's day. I mean, I think that's more comparable to Martin's work than Lord of the Rings is.
Yes. But at the same time, there's also, getting back to the point that Andrew McLaughlin was making, I do think that one of the ways in which so many people, so many fantasy writers have tried to differentiate themselves from Tolkien is to be, as Andrew says, grimdark. Right.
Yes.
That is, you know, the dark fantasy, because, you
yes.
know, in the good guys win in Tolkien, and, you know, good wins and evil is punished. And a lot of, you know, modern people are like, oh, that's not realistic. You know, to me, and this is what I was going to say before as well, the generic difference is a major thing, and I like Tom Hillman's way of construing the generic difference between Tolkien and Martin. But at the same time, I think the whole fundamental, like, philosophical and spiritual outlook of the two works is to me a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the reasons why I basically pledged a long time ago in my classes, I got frustrated with conversations especially in the context of medieval and fantasy works about realism. And I got I it started off as it usually starts off, with me getting sick of students saying something, and I was getting sick of students saying, but that's not realistic, and I found myself getting really frustrated with that. And when I got frustrated with that, I realized how often I used the word realistic when trying to describe something, because basically the fundamental realization that I had is, look, describing something as realistic is not really saying something about the book. You're saying something about your own beliefs when you say that, because it depends upon how what you believe reality is. If you believe, if you have the same spiritual and philosophical beliefs that Tolkien had, you will find The Lord of the Rings realistic. If you have the same beliefs that George R. R. Martin's books seem to embody, you will find that more realistic. But it's really a question of where what your own sensibilities are and what your own beliefs are. The question of reality and what is reality is not as objective a question as it tends to be treated by people. So that and therefore I think a lot of sloppy thinking and a lot of people arguing at cross purposes happen around that concept of realism.
Now, you know, there is one thing our other Andrew, our dressed up Andrew Higgins, points out, which I think is really true. And I think this is something I almost think this is something that makes Tolkien very difficult to compare to any other writer, because I don't know of any other writer, and you guys might, who has devoted so much of his life and has been so detail-oriented in a sub-creation as Tolkien's been. And that alone makes, I mean, not only does it make the story rich and complex, but the amount of energy put into it, if you will, I just don't know of any other writer that's done that.
No, I mean, most writers... I mean, again, Tolkien's there, right, as the model now. Yes. I get to use, and I'm sort of... And I don't mean to just sort of make Ger Martin, as you said, the sort of, you know, the whipping boy
or
of every
Rowling.
Comparison.
I mean,
here.
Rowling, or we could talk
right,
you know,
but here I'm thinking of something. You know, when the Game of Thrones first came out, and people were talking about the Dothraki language, right? And you know, Martin sort of confessed. He's like, you know, like Tolkien's model, suggests that like really big league fantasy sub creators should invent languages, right? I mean, like if you have invented and everybody wanted to like delve into the depth of the Dothraki language, but you know what? It doesn't have depth like Quenya and Sindarin have depth. You know, you can not only learn to speak Quenya and Sindarin in a sense if you're willing to make up verbs, but you also can like study the entire philological history, or you know, as Andrew Higgins might argue, you could like write a whole doctoral dissertation on the history of Tolkien's languages and stuff. That's of course what Andy Higgins is doing, but that kind of depth. I mean, a lot of modern using Tolkien as a model, there are a lot of modern writers who will sort of fake that, or if not fake it, even sort of, you know, going that way, but you go at it from the other end, right? In order to have a really good sub-creation, a really thorough sub-creation, I need to invent a language. Okay, and if you do that, if you follow that through and really invent a language, that's pretty awesome. But you're still not going to get to where Tolkien was, because Tolkien's creation started with his languages, and the whole history and growth and sort of culture and character of those languages, and the way that those languages themselves grew and developed over time, becomes itself a kind of narrative, becomes itself a character, and gives in that way a kind of life and a particular, not just an extent of depth. You know, we're not talking about a quantitative difference, but a qualitatively different kind of depth to stories, which, you know, it's really hard to duplicate. And this is one of the reasons that it's one of the reasons that when people ask me, you know, what modern works do you think really compare to Tolkien? And I usually just think they're fishing and hoping I'll say Martin. But But my answer is usually like, you know, I can never answer that. I never have a good answer to that question because there's nobody who's just like him. It's not to say that other people are all, you know, that, you know, I know it might sound like, hey, I'm the Tolkien professor. So, of course, I'm going to say Tolkien is like the god of fantasy and there will never be a writer like Tolkien, you know. I'm not saying that, but I think it's perfectly fair to say there's never going to be another writer just like him. You know, that's actually kind of true of everybody in its own way. And that's
you're actually
fine.
Kind of doing, you're actually kind of doing those other authors a disservice by doing that.
Yes.
Not that they won't compare favorably, but because it creates expectations of their work that may be inappropriate. Because what I heard Gerard Martin say once was, you know, people ask him this, apparently repeatedly ask him about, like, oh, are you going to tell us more of the language? And he's like, no, because there isn't any. I might make some up if it come. You know, if I need a word, I'll make it up. But he's like, I'm not a linguist.
Right.
Tolkien was. That's what he was interested in. I have no interest in that.
Right. Right.
You know, and I think that's a really good point because there was a guest that Corey had on a podcast a couple of years ago, and I don't remember his name, and I don't necessarily want to because I didn't agree with what he was necessarily talking about, so I don't even want to remember what his name was. But he was a guy who was expert sort of in war.
Military history, yes.
Military history. And his criticism of Tolkien, I specifically remember it centering on the Helm's Deep battle and mm-hmm. Tolkien's description of Helm's Deep. And my thinking through the whole entire criticism was, but that wasn't what Tolkien was interested in.
Right.
So I wouldn't expect him to write to that level of detail, that level of military detail. And I think that's true what you're just saying, Dave, too, which is, you know, Martin apparently does have probably of interest, but not in the linguistics. So, it's apples to oranges oftentimes.
No, I kind of like that interview with that guy.
Yeah. No, that was definitely interesting. But I mean, it is certainly true to say, as you're saying, Tolkien's not interested in this, and instead to say, okay, so what is he doing instead? Both of them have their virtues. Both of them do interesting things, and it's not only a question of personal taste, but also you know, that is, like, some people really like military detail and sort of, you know, technical, you know, like a story which really brings you through the tactics of a battle. I really enjoy that. You know, I mean, it's funny because sometimes when you know, historians, because history has been so focused on, like, royal history and military history for so long, you know, modern historians really sort of, you know, have responded against that and are like, we don't want to just write histories about, like, you know, the ebb and flow of the tides of battle. And I'm kind of like, but I actually really like that. Can I still have some of that? Oh, you know, every once in a while, please. But anyhow, hang on, wait. The point is that it's not just a question of personal taste. The point is that to think about what each story is doing, not just to think about, again, like the absence of battle tactics, of battle tactical descriptions, or the comparative small number of them in Tolkien it's not just, oh, this Tolkien doesn't do this, but instead, what is Tolkien doing? You know, why was it that I found the Battle of Helm's Deep so stirring? And I always found, going back to the Battle of Helm's Deep, I was always surprised at how short it was and how few details there were. Because the Battle of Helm's Deep lived in my mind. As I said, I love battle tactics and I love thinking about this stuff. And I thought about it a lot. And I found the Battle of Helm's Deep really satisfying. But it wasn't because it was all described. Right. And when I go back to it, there's not that much there. But I found in my own imagination, you know, I had fleshed out the Battle of Helm's Deep very, very much based on the outline that Tolkien gives and the incidents that he described. You know, I found it to be deeply satisfying. And I find the Battle of Five Armies very similar. He gives enough detail for you to get a sense of the sort of the narrative shape of the battle. But he leaves you the freedom to invest your own imagination in it or not. And that, I think, is a crucial point. Again, with George R. R. Martin, I am not free not to imagine these things.
Right.
Not at all free. But
now,
with Tolkien, and that's a genre thing, right? What novels do is really bring you in as if you're there, you know, with something. And that's not what, you know, other more traditional genres, you know, older genres did.
But let me ask also another difference. And one point I wanted to make in what you guys just said, which is back to that point of it does do the other authors injustice to try to compare them to Tolkien. I mean, I really do agree with that. The other thing, though, I was wondering in, with regard to Martin, and I don't know because I haven't read the books, but does he – I mean, one key thing about Tolkien I really honestly believe is the consolation and recovery aspects that he realized finally as a result of, you know, that original lecture sort of been – stimulated him to then flesh out the essay that came out in the 50s, which we know is on fairy stories today. But that consolation recovery, does Martin have that in his books?
No.
Okay,
no.
I didn't think so, and I didn't want to assert that he didn't because I hadn't read them, but I didn't get the impression that he did. And I do think that's a key,
just constant abuse.
That's a key thing. It's just constant abuse.
There
just
is no consolation. I always have to seek consolation from George R. R. Martin's books when I read them. That's what I mean. Like I seriously, like I whenever I do read them, and I have, I've made it as far. I've made it as far as the end of book three. That's when my stamina most recently gave out. And I always, as soon as I finish reading George R. Martin, I go back and like the last time I read books 1, 2, and 3 straight through, and I had to go back and like reread the entire Chronicles of Narnia afterwards just to like cleanse myself, you know, and to like get myself back into a frame of mind, you know, like it's there is not any consolation. I have found no. I mean, in Tolkien's terms, now I find no consolation. There is even when good things happen. Which does occasionally happen in George R. R. Martin's books.
Don't you just have to learn to wait for the other shoe to drop with Martin?
Yes, always. 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 If I mean, I was pleasantly surprised at the end of Game of Thrones. Spoiler alert! If people haven't read them, I was pleasantly surprised when Robb won the battle at River Run and took Jaime Lannister prisoner. I didn't expect that to happen. I was totally assuming that Robb was going to be killed horribly in the battle. And when he won and survived both, I was like, well, hey, wow, that was cool. But of course, like for every battle of River Run, you know, you get a red wedding in George R. R. Martin. So, you know, it's no, I have not found that kind of consolation.
You know, and I mean, that's almost kind of like a fundamental difference between the two. It can kind of certainly explains my sort of antipathy for reading the Game of Thrones series. So,
No, it's difficult. But let's on the subject of console, we should probably get back to
I had thought about pulling this back, but I must say, one of the reasons why hopefully listeners listening today and also in the future will get value out of this, because we actually have talked quite a bit about the Hobbit already.
We have, exactly.
I don't think we're missing out on much.
No, and I think that this is, but I mean, I really think that this, in its way, this is a very relevant conversation to have as we approach the Battle of Five Armies and thinking about how the film is going to be handling the Battle of Five Armies. Because one of the questions, and this is, you know, one of the questions, and Trish, you were asking this in our notes for today's session, how many new catastrophes are going to happen, and how are they going to come about? In other words, to what extent is the film version of the Battle of Five Armies going to sort of follow in that spirit of the book? Now, obviously, one of the differences with film and story is that you have to show things, right? You can't just be suggestive. You can't just be evocative. It goes back to the thing that Tolkien was talking about in On Fairy Stories when he talked about drama, right? And the illustration he gave where he says, you know, if, when you're telling a story, you can simply use the word bread. You know, they ate bread. And the reader is free to imagine any very, you know, there's a lot of ways in which bread can be and in which bread can look. And their imagination is not tied to a particular, you know, but if you are doing a play, you have to have an actual incarnate loaf of bread on the stage. And therefore, the imaginations of the viewers are restricted to what's actually there. Right. The same is true of film. Right. You know, so we can't just be like, I mean, unless something happens off stage just with exposition, that'd be a great climax to the third film, wouldn't it be? Right. The Battle of Five Armies doesn't actually happen on screen. We just hear about it afterwards, you know, which, of course, is how half of the Battle of Five Armies happens in the book. But generally, you know, you actually have to show things on screen, and so you have to make lots of choices, which, as a storyteller, you don't have to make. You're not at all compelled to make those choices. You don't have to choose some of the details which are often left out in Tolkien's books, like people's hair color, for instance, often just not described. You know, what exactly do they look like? What are their, you know, the detailed facial descriptions of particular people are very, very rare in Tolkien. You know,
we don't know. The presence or absence of wings, right?
No, he's quite clear about that. He's quite clear about that. Yeah, no, that's a total non-issue, obviously. But no, I mean, like, you know, so the kinds of things that, you know, that again in a novel would seem almost mandatory. You know, like, what's Sam's face like? Sam have a big nose? We don't know. You know, like it's we're never told, right? We're told he has an honest face, right? And our imagination is left to fill in what that looks like. So
Robert Brown and Philip Lord both said pointed ears. I thought it was like, I thought it was a double entry, but no, it's two different people
at the same time said pointed ears. Yeah,
presence
exactly.
Or absence of pointed ears.
Yep. And you have to make a choice in how pointed they are and what they look like exactly. But anyway, so in the film, we're going to show this, which means already now there's going to be necessarily, a difference between film depiction, where you're actually going to be showing the battle and you're going to be showing, you know, depicting the violence, not just saying that the violence is happening, but actually, you know, depicting, you know, orc heads being cut off and dwarves being chopped up by orcs and everything else. Like, this is going to happen on screen. So already we have a different situation brought about not necessarily by choices, though again, choices will enter into it, but by genre. Right? By medium. So then the question is, with the choices that they do have to make, are they going to, how are they going to stick to the spirit of Eucatastrophe? Because the Battle of Five Armies is the classic Eucatastrophic moment in Tolkien. I mean, it is the paradigmatic Eucatastrophe. The Eagles Are Coming is the paradigmatic Eucatastrophe in Tolkien. And it's not just that, right? We get several small Eucatastrophe moments, right, leading up to that. We get Thorin's charge. We get the arrival of Beorn, which we only hear about later on. And we get the eagles. Are we going to get all of those things? And to me, more importantly, are all of them going to be handled Eucatastrophically? Are we going to get those... are we going to get that effect? Bjorn might be there. Is he just going to be there from the beginning and participate in the battle? Or are we going to have his arrival at the battle be a sudden and sort of cataclysmic intervention? Is that how it's going to be handled? Is Thorin going to be forgotten about for most of the battle and then charge out unexpected, or once everyone has forgotten about him, throw down the gate and charge out in the middle? Is that how it's going to happen? And the eagles, you know... Is the right now? Of course, we've already gotten the arrival of the eagles, and the arrival of the eagles. You know, in the book, both of the arrivals of the eagles are also, in their sense, eucatastrophic. You know, both their lives are suddenly saved by the eagles.
Well, the eagles arriving in the movie, the first arrival that we've seen with the eagles in the movie was not as eucatastrophic as it was in the book, because we had the moth, you know, relaying Gandalf's message in the movie.
Right.
I guess one question would be, you know, is it going to be like that again, or are the eagles really going to truly be a Eucatastrophe in this movie? I hope so. I hope they are. I don't want to see another moth relay.
Right.
Or even any other bird or insect relay from Gandalf.
Man, I don't know if they'll do it though. Like, they've demonstrated a substantial reluctance to have the eagles just show up. I feel like every time they've been on screen, an explanation has been provided.
But at the end of Return of the King, didn't they just show
up? I was just thinking that too. We do have that one example where they do just seem to show up at the end of the Return of the King.
It would be an interesting parallel, given that it's kind of almost the same moment.
Yes. You start off by moth, and then the eagles take initiative at the end. Yeah, it would be exactly the same pattern. Good. Brian, Biggs was just pointing that out, that they did get the eucatastrophic arrival of the Eagles right in the Return of the King. Oh, good. And Yana was also pointing that out. My prediction is that the Eagle arrival will be eucatastrophic. I do think we're going to get that. The eucatastrophe I am most, or the, you know, the sort of the eucatastrophic moment I am most uncertain about, or least confident in for the film, is Thorin's. I don't think they're going to do that with Thorin. Because in order to do it just like the book, he'd have to be a non-participant in most of the battle. And the other thing that I'm thinking as far as the narrative structure of the film is concerned, especially since I am presuming that the Battle of Five Armies is going to give us a climactic fight between Thorin and Azog, I am assuming that the sort of the narrative structure of the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar, as it was given to us in film one, is going to be relevant to the Battle of Five Armies. That we already have sort of an anticipation of this, and to what extent, and not that it's necessarily going to follow exactly the same model, but I suspect that the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar was a deliberate setup for what's going to happen in the Battle of Five Armies. Not quite sure exactly how that's going to work, but I would expect that to be true. So, you know, and again, and just to summarize a little bit more what I mean by that, the narrative shape of the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar in film one was, you know, the dwarves fight valiantly, but then they come near to disaster, and then, Thorin has his, come from behind, moment where he heroically turns the tide of the battle by his stroke of individual courage. That still is in its way a kind of anticipation for a eucatastrophic intervention on Thorin's part. I mean, you could almost say that his dismemberment of Azog acted like a kind of eucatastrophe in the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar. But that's different, you see. I mean, it's different when the kinds of things that I'm calling eucatastrophic here is they need to be sort of sudden and external, right? It can't just be like, a boxing match in which one guy is kind of winning most of the time and then the guy who's been losing the whole battle like rears back and like knocks the guy out unexpectedly with a perfectly timed blow to the head, and therefore he comes from behind and unexpectedly wins. That's not a eucatastrophe. That's an upset, but it's not a eucatastrophe.
Right.
So in this way, I wouldn't really characterize Thorin's actions in the Battle of Azan-ul-Bazar is eucatastrophic. It was an upset, but it wasn't a eucatastrophe.
Although Brian Biggs does point out that the oak log at Azan-ul-Bazar could have been eucatastrophic.
The intervention of the log. Yes. Yes. Nah, that was just the instrument of his upset. And by the way, I still haven't come to grips with the symbolic significance of Thorin losing his oaken shield.
That log,
Unless, actually, come to think of it, I've totally forgotten to think about that this year. Unless we see that as the first stage of Thorin's losing it, basically. That basically what we are seeing in his speech to Keeley on the docks at Lake Town, you've got to learn that a real king a real king can't let the good of one dwarf stand in the way of the greater objective.
Real kings also don't carry around logs.
That could have been
Hey man, true epic kings carry around logs. Okay, like that's perfectly okay. Don't discriminate against log carrying kings. Are you some of like anti log carrying bigot over here, Dave? Like you're saying real kings can't carry logs?
No, I was just following your line of logic.
No, that is not my line of logic at all. The point is that that basically he has begun, like, his losing his oaken shield there, which was the moment when he became a king, right? Remember, that was how Balin characterized it. That was the moment when I knew, like, this was a king that I would follow. He's lost that. Like, this is like the beginning of Thorin losing his way.
I think you're being really benevolent.
He's Jackson not going
to
regain his identity at the end. Hey, look, it's not about Jackson, man. It's about the movie. I don't care if he intended it or not. I didn't ask his opinion. I'm telling him what's there. This is always my opinion about authors. You know, I don't care if he intended it.
That's right.
If it makes a good story,
it's the unthought about stuff. That
exactly. It's about meaning, not about intention.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Okay. Okay.
That's actually a good start for a paper. You know, post film.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. No, as soon as I saw that at the end of the first film, I was like, "There's a lot here." But I still have to think about that a lot more. Like, as soon as I saw the slow-mo shot of his oaken shield falling to the ground, I was like, that's very meaningful. I don't yet know what it means, but that's very meaningful.
Well, I had the same thought and was, in fact, surprised there was absolutely no mention whatsoever of the shield in the second movie. I mean, I was surprised given how much focus there was on it in the first movie.
Well, it's a sensitive subject. Nobody wants to bring it up.
Nobody wants to bring it up around Thorin.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, did you guys see how Thorin totally dropped his... I guess we can't call him Thorin Oakenshield anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
But don't say that to his face.
Yeah, exactly.
Thorin
Ixnay on the Oakenshield.
Yeah, on the Oakenshield,
yeah. A. Yeah. How do you do pig Latin with a word that sounds... with starts with a vowel, by the way? I don't even know.
Well, you could do Oakenay Ilche.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. Anyway.
Hey.
Yeah.
Have you considered the possibility that the eagles went back and retrieved it?
So when the eagles arrive, they drop his shield to it. Yeah. Oh, I'm with you.
Oh.
I'm with you. Yeah. Yeah. It's like identity. You catastrophe. Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the moment that will be Thorin's heroic redemption moment when the shield falls out of the sky and he catches it and he remembers the king he should be.
Yes, Thorin is reunited with his log. Yeah.
Well, and then you see, you know, it totally makes sense that he would be buried, you know, with his log and his stone.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. He's got his log beneath his feet and the Ark and stone on his breast.
Which is not meant to be symbolic of anything in particular.
No, exactly. Well, please let's not get Freudian on this.
Or Chaucerian.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
His stick and his stone.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Sometimes a log is
so
just
where
a log.
Were we?
But anyway, yes, by all means, let us get. But we're at Eucatastrophe. So Thorin, yeah, basically my fundamental skepticism about Thorin as Eucatastrophe in the film is that I don't think they're just going to keep him on the sidelines for that long. I mean, which happens. Most of the battle happens while Thorin is not participating in the book. And that's right. What I can't imagine in the film.
Well, by the way, as far as Eucatastrophe, we haven't talked about Dayan, however you pronounce his name. His arrival is likely, don't you think, to be catastrophic in the movie? I mean, we may know he's coming, but they won't know he's coming, kind of thing.
Yeah, that is a really good question. It is possible that the arrival of the dwarves will be Eucatastrophe mid-battle kind of thing.
Right.
That's possible.
Turn the tide kind of thing.
Right. I tend to think not. The primary reason I think not is that, first of all, I think we're going to want Dayan and stuff there to ratchet up the tension pre-battle. So that we can have either an actual battle, especially since I believe I predicted that an actual battle was going to be joined between the elves and dwarves before the other battle. So I'm now obligated to say that I think that Dayan is going to be there in advance. But
I was thinking he might be more like the Rohirrim on the Pelennor Fields, you know, where
yeah,
they show up.
Yeah, I don't think so. But I could see basically Bjorn playing that role. You know, Bjorn being the functional equivalent of the entire army of the Rohirrim.
I was thinking Bjorn may be more like the Corsair ship.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So just as they see the black sails coming and tragically and ironically despair at the sight, so other people are going to see an enormous monstrous bear approaching and believe that that's a bad thing, when in fact it's going to turn out unexpectedly to be a good thing. Yes. Yeah, I see the parallel. I'm with you. but basically, as with the Rohirrim, their advent to the battle had a eucatastrophic element, definitely. I mean, yes. You know, it doesn't determine the outcome of the battle, right? You know, in the end, it's not the deciding factor.
Right.
And that's the same is true of Bjorn, right? Bjorn arrives and he's the one who kills Bolg, who kills the general of the opposing army. But his arrival is not what is decisive.
It's eucatastrophic in the sense of putting heart back into the...
Yes.
Into
yes.
the...
Yes.
Combatants, kind of.
Yep. Yep.
You know. You know, one of the things, I might be off, sliding off topic a bit here, but about Thorin, you know, we were just joking about, you know, the log may fall from the eagle, and he'll remember his kingship. In the book, anyway, doesn't Thorin pretty much stay crazy Thorin up until the time he gets his fatal wound? Isn't it the deathbed situation that kind of turns his...
Well, it's hard because, of course, like, nobody, like, sits down for a heart-to-heart with Thorin while he's charging onto the battlefield, so, like...
we don't really know for
sure. But my personal...
We have no man on the street with a microphone.
Exactly, right. Yeah, sadly, it was not the modern era where, like, every climactic event is interrupted by niggling sideline reporters who come and ask you inane questions in the moment, you know, to ruin
Thorin
the moment.
You just won the Battle of Five Armies.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. Yeah. I mean, surely we would have had, you know, interviews with the generals on each sideline during the middle of the battle. So that, yeah, no. Sadly, we did not have these advantages back, you know, in these stories. But it is my interpretation that Thorin's amendment happens then.
Happens
at his charge, yes. My primary reason for saying that is what seems to me the very important symbolic fact of the throwing down of the wall.
They
didn't have to do that. You know, they could have just jumped down or climbed down. Nobody was really paying attention to them, so you know the dwarves could have climbed, scaled down with ropes, and stood there, you know, and formed themselves up and then charged, right? But the throwing down of the wall, because that wall block, because the gates of the king play a really important role, you know, symbolically in the story, you know, that it's an important emblem of the kingdom of Erebor in The Hobbit. And therefore, the fact that Thorin has bricked up the gates of the king, and the way in which the bricking up of the gates of the king seems to me a very appropriate sort of outward manifestation of Thorin's attitude at that time. You know, the way in which he is stonewalling, you know, Bard, even when Bard's claims are quite just, and his claims upon Thorin are very reasonable, and yet Thorin will have nothing to do with it. He is showing, he is showing an attitude which is the opposite of, you know, the former kings of the, you know, at the gates the king awaits, you know, the dwarves sing in their revised song. But we don't get, in fact, a king who is waiting at the gates, you know, whose hands are rich with gems and gold. Instead, we get a king who has blocked out the gates and refuses to deal any gems and gold to anybody. Right. And that's antipathetic to what the king is supposed to be. So when he throws down the wall and he charges out and says, "To me, elves and men, to me, my kindred."
That Kate says too is that he's also calling to the elves and men, not
exactly.
just to the dwarves.
Exactly. Yeah. So that now you know. The actual speech he delivers to Bilbo, I think, you know, there may be some things that he's only really realizing and processing there on his deathbed, but I feel that the turn in his character happens at the moment.
Do you think we'll get another quotable, like, "But this, that is not this day," speech?
A speech
like
from Thorin.
That can be turned into a meme for years to come.
I can see that.
And if not from Thorin, then from whom? Bard?
Not Bard, maybe. I don't
Toriel?
See anything else to me. Toriel?
Actually,
Legolas.
Yeah, no, wait, no, Toriel, hang on, hang with me here. You know, Miss, this is our fight. She's the one with the best big picture pep talk. I mean, her speech to Legolas is the closest thing we've gotten to that in any of the films. She's the one who, of all of the characters in the story, has been the only one who has both sort of seen the big picture and been outspoken. It's basically like mm-hmm. Toriel, Gandalf, and Bilbo have been the three characters who are able to like see outside their own personal, you know, mm-hmm. interests.
Right.
And that's what has differentiated them. The main difference between Toriel and Bilbo is that Bilbo doesn't speak it out. You know, he's right. rarely had that moment. It's one of the reasons that his speech, at the end of the first film, both of his speeches, primarily the speech that he gives right after they're reunited on the side of the mountain. That's why that speech is really significant in that first film, because he doesn't talk like that. He doesn't talk much at all.
Right.
Whereas Toriel does. She's outspoken. And so don't laugh. I actually think Toriel's a good candidate for somebody who actually speaks out the thing that everybody else needs to hear. I could see that.
The other thing is she could infect Keeley, and Keeley could do the speech. I mean, I personally yep. like the idea of Toriel doing it, but I'm just, you know, trying to think of other possibilities. But yeah, I mean, like Tom Hillman says, Toriel will deliver the Agincourt speech. For the dwarf that sheds his blood with me today shall be my brother, be he never so short. Tom, you are on fire today. Tom Hillman is on fire today.
Yeah, that's very good. That's very good. Yes. Yeah, though I suppose that Toriel can't exactly deliver the, like, shall count his manhood cheap or a line either.
Right?
Really, for two reasons. I mean, her talking about manhood would be doubly inappropriate, I suppose.
Now, you know, another person who could do it, because we have talked about him having a change of heart, is Thranduil, but I personally don't see that. I just, even with a change of heart, I don't really
no,
see
it. No, even with a change of heart, I don't no. see him delivering a speech.
No.
Yeah,
he's not really the speech-making kind.
No.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, well, I'm hoping we do get some kind of, like, rally to the troops speech prior.
Yeah. I think what's more likely, though, again, given the build-up, given the fact that we're still in one way or another kind of expecting the Battle of Five Armies to happen suddenly. I mean, there was an option for the non-sudden beginning of the Battle of Five Armies. You know, that is, they have full warning of the Goblin Army and are bracing themselves for the defense. In that
right.
case,
right.
we could have the opportunity for somebody to, you know, ride down the line like Theoden and deliver a speech. But if the orcs just come upon them unexpectedly, or if they're in the middle of fighting each other, there's not an opportunity for somebody to make a speech like that. However, there's plenty of time. What I would see instead would be a speech delivered from one character to another in the middle of a battle.
Yes.
Not like an oration, of course, but
right.
for there to be a significant exchange or a significant, you know, quote emerging from that kind of an environment.
Now, don't pelt me with something. Okay, virtually. I hate to bring it up again, because we've talked about it so much, but where do you think the Arkenstone's going to be in all this? I mean, do you think it'll be in somebody's pocket and just kind of, like, forgotten about during the battle, or...?
Well, my thought is, yes, unless the magical potency of the Arkenstone
that's right.
that is probably going to be revealed in the third film is relevant in some way.
That's a conundrum, by the way, Dave, that you'll be answering when we do the review.
Yes.
Does the Arkenstone prove
actually,
to have some
like,
kind of...
have magical powers.
Magical powers.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, I'll put you down. I think, didn't you and I both say no? Or I think we both said yes, didn't we?
I said yes, yeah. I said yes to that. I do think
that
it's going to end up having magical powers.
That was
a wish fulfillment
as
answer?
Much on hope. Yeah,
yes.
yeah. That's based as much on hope as me. In fact,
yeah.
that's based driven primarily by hope.
Yes.
That was less a, oh, no, I don't think it'll have magical powers. No, please, come on.
No, please don't have magical powers.
Yes. Right, yes.
Yeah, so if that's the case, then it could actually figure in the battle in some way, huh? Like a He-Man thing, you know, when he lifts his sword and says, "I am the power."
By the power of Grayskull, yeah.
By the power of Grayskull, that's
right.
Yeah,
there we go.
By the way, let's stipulate that holding it up and having all the dwarves get really excited and motivated and fighting harder
doesn't count.
Magic
powers. Yeah. Yeah, no.
But a bat signal that brings Dian in could be magical, right?
Yes.
Like a bat signal, kind of, you know, a dwarf signal.
Wait, I think we also have to suss out the details of magical. Is it magical in sort of mystical powers, or is it magical in sort of magitechnical powers, like a walkie-talkie or a bat signal?
Well, actually, I think I brought up at some point, didn't I say something about how it could be a Palantir? Oh, no. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, you did. In the magitechnical sense, Dave, that is not just magical in the sense that it is like, you know, wondrous and mythic and, you know,
oh, right.
Yeah. but like it actually does stuff.
Something.
Yeah.
It functions.
It has some kind of function, which function occurs by magic. Yes, exactly.
I still say no, but
yeah. Yeah. Interesting. I think that our best chance for you catastrophe I suspect that Bjorn is going to happen much like it does in the book. I think we're going to get a book answer with Bjorn. The one wild card there is his connection to Dol Guldur, if any. And we know he has some connection. We have the...
Unfortunately, we also know that Gandalf won't be riding him to battle, because we've already seen Gandalf riding that horse.
Riding that horse, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which is now for sale. We have the unassailable authority of the Lego set to demonstrate that Bjorn is going to be involved in Dol Guldur in some sense. We have to keep that in mind. I have to admit, I am so excited about the Lego sets this year that I've been like actually watching the Lego sites waiting for them to
come out.
I don't know,
yeah,
man.
There's
nothing more. You know, trailers are cool and everything, but I'm looking forward to the release of the new Lego sets much more than I'm looking forward to the release of the trailers.
Maybe
frankly.
At Comic-Con, Dave, keep an eye out for Lego sets.
Yeah, if you see anything at Comic-Con, you have to at least send us good pictures.
Definitely.
Yeah.
If not actual Legos.
Oh, better. That's
Actual Legos, it would be even better. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So, we should, I suppose, move towards our riddle because we've kind of gone long here.
This has been such an excellent lecture on, you know, other things than just The Hobbit.
Right. Yes.
We've been mired in
the philosophy of fiction writing.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so the big question is, you know, the big question we've been beating, you know, we've been sort of beating around this for a long time is who dies in the Battle of Five Armies? And let me say right at the outset, anybody who receives a mortal wound in the battle and dies afterwards counts, okay? So Thorin still getting a deathbed scene afterwards still counts as dying at the Battle of Five Armies. We're not getting into hair splitting here. So first, before we do the riddle, because our riddle is going to be about dwarf deaths in particular. So before we get to dwarf deaths, let us address non-dwarf deaths. The primary questions there, obviously, are elf-related. Toriel. Is Toriel going to die?
Yes,
I think she is.
Yeah, I think I started predicting her death about 5 minutes after I discovered her existence. So
yes.
I have to remain consistent with that. I think that she's gonna die. And I don't think this for. I think that arguments in favor of the death of a character based entirely on, like, consistency reasons, like, well, Toriel wasn't around in The Lord of the Rings, so she has to die. There's some legitimacy to those arguments, but I find them kind of weak. Like, that's not a good reason for her to die. She needs a good reason within the context of this story to die in the Battle of Five Armies. And I think that that reason exists. I think the reason exists for the effect that it's likely to have on Legolas and the way in which the role in which that can play, the role which that can play in his own growth. But of course, how awful is it to say, like, the important thing about Toriel's death is the effect that she has on Orlando Bloom, but rather that for her own sake, for the role that she as a character is playing in this story, there is an extent to which her death is the final expression of the speech that she was giving to Legolas, you know, on that little ayat or whatever, wherever they were in film one. That is to say, to show that she is willing to, you know, to give her life in this cause that she has been arguing. That there's a way in which her death on the battlefield, I think, is going to give a kind of authenticity to the argument that she's been making, which has obviously been shown to be countercultural to the elves. And I think that her death on the battlefield is sort of going to be the final sort of demonstration that she's right and they're wrong. Basically, you know, so that's why I think within this, the context of this story, her death has the opportunity to be really very meaningful. And then you add the fact that Kiwi's likely to die too. So then we'll get like the sort of star-crossed and never fully consummated in a literal or figurative sense relationship between Kiwi and Toriel. And the two of them dying on the battlefield, this I think is something that could really work well in several ways.
So I could see her death being the final turning point for Thranduil and Legolas in terms of joining the war.
Yes, or maybe they go in opposite directions. Yeah, because of course it's possible to respond to it and to say, see, this proves her wrong, right? This is exactly why I'm an isolationist. Thank you very much. it's conceivable that maybe Thranduil never changes, and maybe, in fact, this whole experience hardens him, and he goes back and he's like, well, that's the last time I ever leave this cave again.
I
doubt it, but I could see that. I mean, I think that it's a kind of narrative that, you know, that functions, you know, that would make sense. Anybody else? Any other non-dwarves besides Toriel that you think has a good chance of dying on the battlefield?
Does our scope of deaths consider Smaug's attack? Because I'm definitely thinking a bard daughter or two.
A bard daughter or two, yeah. I was thinking that too. Just thinking again, like I was saying, what Tolkien does in the book, the way that he goes out of his way to sort of make the disaster, you know, the human cost of the destruction of Esgaroth really hit home. The most powerful way to do that in the film, I believe, would be with a dead daughter, absolutely.
Yeah, but I guess we should focus on Battle of Five Armies today. I do also think Radagast is not long for the world, but I don't think that'll happen at Battle of Five Armies.
No, Saruman's already killed him at the Battle of Guldur. Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering. I sort of feel like the Master and/or Alfred. But again, not sure whether that'll be Battle of Five Armies, Smaug's attack, or starving in the wilderness. Pointing elf, I think he's in trouble.
You're saying you wouldn't be selling a life insurance policy to Pointing Elf right now?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I hear ya.
Pointing elf, the red shirt of the Hobbit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe also in terms of named characters, I think.
How about Alfred? Do we think Alfred?
Azog and or Bolg.
Yes.
Alfred and the Master. I guess I'm not sure. I feel like one or the other, or maybe both, will both die. But I'm not sure. but I don't be skeptical if they were actually in the battle.
It's hard to imagine Alfred anywhere near the battle.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he doesn't really seem like I'm going to put on armor and join the ranks kind of guy.
unless it was some sort of, where sort of Bard and his new followers compel him. Like, sort of, he's like at the front of the army marching toward the mountain with somebody behind him jabbing him in the back with the spear. Keep moving there, Alfred.
Right.
You're going in first.
Right. Alfred is the one-man cannon fodder of the army.
Yeah,
of Lake Town.
That's the only circumstance under which you could reasonably expect him to go near the battle.
Agreed, yeah. Agreed. I don't think... And I don't expect, by the way, I don't expect the field to be littered with named corpses. I mean, I don't expect that to happen. I mean,
I do expect it to be littered with corpses.
Oh, yeah, plenty of corpses. And, of course, several named characters die in the book. So, that's going to happen. But I don't think we're going to be killing. And frankly, there aren't too many other good candidates. I mean, Bard needs to live. Bard's son needs to live. The Elven King really does need to live because he's referred to, I mean, he's still there later on. Legolas obviously needs to live. There's Bilbo needs to live. So this Gandalf needs to live. There's not that many options for people who would die.
Are we talking about the Dwarves of Erebor yet? Or?
Well, let's go ahead and transition to that. I wanted to make sure we on record with the Toro question.
About
that.
Okay.
Can we do orcs really fast?
Yeah, let's do orcs really fast.
Yeah, Azog and Bolg. Not even sure if they'll even make it.
They'll even make it to the battle?
Yeah, they might die before then. But
yeah.
I mean, that I think is one of the details about which I'm least clear. Which of them is going to be there, and who's going to be in charge of what, and leading which army? And
yeah, Azog was put in charge of the army, so presumably that's going to put him in the in the captain's role in the battle itself.
Yeah,
we've been sort of assuming we're going to get a climactic battle between Thorin and Azog. This, of course, would be an interesting riddle on its own. Who kills Azog? Or didn't we already have this riddle once, or do we just talk about it?
Yeah, our very first riddle was is Azog going to die in the battle? And who kills Azog?
Yeah, because of course the book answer is Dan, which is still actually a live possibility in an utterly different context. there's Thorin, there's Bilbo, there's because I do think Bilbo is going to play a more significant role. And again, we had the setup of Bilbo coming in and saving Thorin's life when Azog was about to kill him, in the out of the frying pan scene. So that could be an anticipation of something that's going to happen in the Battle of Five Armies. We could have Bjorn, of course, in a different sense, Bjorn would be the book answer, right? That Bjorn comes in and kills the leader and general of the orc armies. So if that's Azog, Bjorn killing Azog would also, in a different sense, be the book answer. So that I don't expect, by the way. I don't expect Bjorn to come in and climactically kill a named orc. I think he's going to come in and his intervention is going to be pivotal. But I don't expect him to be the one who comes in out of left field and kills Azog. Maybe Bolg. I could see him killing Bolg.
Yeah. Which would be a book answer. And we did talk about, I think maybe it was within the context of that episode, we talked about, what might be the configuration of how Thorin gets his fatal wound. We've talked about, I think, before. I think in this riddle we talked about, and I think, Corey, you were the one that argued for, you felt that Thorin needed to be the one killing Azog, as opposed to being helped by, other people.
I kind of do. Well, when I think about the effect,
you may change your mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I might, but I don't know. I mean, when I think about the effect of it, the fact is, we're going to get, you know, I assume he's going to die and we're going to get a deathbed scene. But at the same time, the sort of conversion moment of Thorin, his actions in the battlefield have to demonstrate this, you know? And I feel like there has to be a certain amount of closure to his actions on the battlefield.
Right.
And for that reason, I would kind of lean towards that. We can save some more. We'll be talking about Thorin next time, so
we can
kind of save a little bit of this and maybe even come back to the Azog question some in the context of next week talking about Thorin. But yeah, I'm not. I agree with you, Dave. I don't feel at all clear on what is the logical sort of destiny of those characters, of the orc right. characters.
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah. In some sense, I'm dead certain they will both die.
Right. Right.
Like that seems incontrovertible. But yeah. But under what circumstances and by whom, by whose hand, I really have no clear idea.
Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we should launch the riddle now. Let's talk about dwarves.
Okay.
Yep.
So okay. So our riddle. It was complicated making a five-option riddle for, you know, the who dies question because there's so many possibilities. But focusing on Erebor, I want to try to explain sort of the narrative concept here. My goal with the riddles is not just to make the riddles trivia questions, but to have them be narrative questions, story questions. You know, the question is, what kind of story do you think is going to be told? How is the story going to go? And so to summarize this, because if I just read them all out as they are, it's going to be a little... I'll do that too, but it's going to be a little confusing. So let me explain first the narrative concept of these answers. Book A is the book answer, as always. So Thorin, Fiwi, and Kiwi die. There are really four fundamentally different story options. One is the book answer. The second is the dwarf body count is going to be increased. Peter Jackson is going to choose to ratchet up the death toll among the dwarves of Erebor. Option C,
possibly even up to the level of the cartoon.
Possibly even exactly that's the choice that the Rankin Bass film made when they killed off six or seven of the dwarves in the Battle of Five Armies. Option C is he's going to reduce the body count. Thorin's still going to die, but he's not going to kill off Fili and or Kili. One or both of them are going to survive. So, you know, fewer than three dwarves die. D is because we have to have this as an option, Thorin lives. He does not, in fact, choose to kill off Thorin. And for option D, I don't care who else dies. If all 12 of the other dwarves die and Thorin lives, D is the correct answer. Because, again, here the pivotal thing is he going to make the narrative, the monumental narrative choice to leave Thorin alive at the end of the film? If he makes that choice, the answer is D. And then E is none of the above. So E is where we accommodate some kind of combination. Like, say, for instance, if Thorin dies,
but
Fili lives, but Bofur and Dwalin both die, that would be E. So we get extra dwarves die, but Fili lives, therefore the answer is E. So again, so A...
And Dori usurps the throne.
And Dori usurps the throne, exactly. So again, A, book answer, everybody knows that. B, more dwarf deaths. C, fewer dwarf deaths. D, Thorin lives. E, none of the above, some other combination. Those are our options. I do mean dwarves in the company. We're only talking about the 13 here. Dan doesn't count.
So
dwarves,
they aren't
just the 13 dwarves.
Yeah. So I think really, the only person, as Andrew McLaughlin points out, the only person, at least using Lord of the Rings film continuity as our guiding light, the only two people we can confidently say won't die are Glóin and Balin.
Right. Right.
And I don't remember if they mentioned Bofur in the we know Glóin must
survive. Oh, and Nori.
No, actually Glóin already had Glóin's already had Gimli. Gimli's already so
Gimli's
Glóin's,
around,
Glóin's
yeah.
also fair.
Glóin is totally
superfluous.
We saw
him
at
the
Yeah, but we didn't know that we saw
him. Oh, no. Don't we see him?
Yeah, but we don't know that we're seeing
him. Yeah, that's true. We just saw him.
He's not introduced by name. So I don't feel that Jackson is bound by consistency with the Fellowship of the Ring film to keep glowing alive. Now, again, in the book,
The only person he has to keep alive is Balin, because we see his corpse, or see
his
tomb.
In Moria. Yes, exactly.
But several people also did ask the question, just, I don't think this is a crucial point to the delineation of the riddles, but sort of, what do you imagine happens with Dian if Keeley or Feely lives?
Well, I would have to assume, we'd have to assume he doesn't become king. So, I mean, yeah, it's the question of the succession. That's one of the reasons why I think option C is not just a choice to kill off fewer people, but it's also the choice. It's going to have significant consequences, because
right.
if Feely or Keeley live, we have an heir.
Again, Jackson isn't required to stick to the books in that regard, because no mention is made of Erebor or the in the Lord of the Rings movies.
Right. Exactly. So there's no I don't think there's any external compulsion upon him to prevent Feely from becoming king, for instance.
Right.
I still think that Keeley is doomed for death. Primarily because of his relationship with Toriel. I mean, it's like the two of them dying on the battlefield is pretty much the only kind of happily ever after they can have. Happily very briefly is different from happily ever after,
that's
I suppose.
Right.
But
and we've been told that it's a pretty tear jerky.
Yeah,
if I recall right from the interview so far.
Yeah. So no, I mean, I definitely do think that. I think Keeley's survival is deeply unlikely, but Feely, especially with the setup that we have drawing attention to the fact that Feely is his heir, that's not even mentioned in the book, by the way, until after their deaths. I mean, nowhere does it say you are my heir and you shall take over from me. Like, there's no sense of Thorin grooming Feely in the book, but we do get that reference in the film. So seeing Feely take over for his uncle could totally happen.
By the way, I apologize for my typo in A. Feely and Kill.
Feely and Kill.
Thoroughly Feely and Kill.
Yeah, you're making Kiwi look Welsh there, you know.
Yes.
Vowels
yes.
optional. I'm not making fun of Welsh, by the way. I love the Welsh language. It's just,
actually, it would be Kiss
yes.
if it was Welsh.
Exactly.
No, that's a really good point I hadn't thought of, that Feely actually, could actually live and take over as king in Jackson's universe.
Why not? Yeah, it could happen.
Yeah.
It could happen. Yeah. So
I don't even want to think about D. Well, first of all, I just think D is so unlikely, just based on what Armitage has said so far.
Yeah, I refuse to accept that's even a possibility. Yeah. Yeah. No, I do too. There's no way I can believe that. But again, primarily it's, I know that people have continually said about the Hobbit films in particular, these films have just left the books entirely behind. And I have again and again argued, no, they don't. They do different things, they add different stuff, but they have never just forgotten the books. And to leave Thorin alive would be exactly the kind of fundamental change that they haven't made. I mean, I still say that I don't think there has been any change to the plot of the story. In their adaptation from book to film in The Hobbit, there is no change that they have made which is in my mind comparable to the change that they made with Aragorn's character, to have him have turned from that path years ago, and him being unwilling or reluctant and for Boromir to have heard of him before, and that change to Aragorn's character in The Fellowship of the Ring is, I think, a more profound departure from Tolkien's story than anything they've done in The Hobbit. And having Thorin survive would be comparable. In what they're doing. Both Philip and Kurt are bringing up Faramir's. I disagree. I disagree. It comes right up to the precipice, but Faramir in the end does let them go and say, like, the interlude of Faramir saying, "I'm going to bring you back to my father," is an exaggeration of, you know, basically Peter Jackson is exaggerating Faramir's daddy complex and is pulling Faramir down about 8 pegs of greatness. Absolutely. I'm not trying to defend, believe me, the change in Faramir, as I've always found it one of the two most appalling character shifts that he did. The most appalling, of course, being Treebeard. But at least, you know, in my own personal opinion. But, however, again, it's not a final change in the trajectory. At the end of the day, Faramir ends up playing a role which is at least kind of comparable. Again, the nature of him is changing, but it's not. I still would not count that as nearly as fundamental a change as saying, instead of having Aragorn as, you know, the lost and new catastrophic heir of the ancient line who has been waiting and preparing for this day and whose hour has now come and is going to return and become king, to change that fundamental story into, you know, I don't think I should be king, I don't want to be king, everybody knows, like Boromir knows who he is and the significance of that, but he's turned away. That changes the plot, I think, in a very, very remarkable way. Kurt says he sees my point, but he's still appalled. Totally with you, Kurt. Not trying to argue out of being appalled by Faramir. Just that I don't think it's nearly as fundamental a change to the story, the shape of the story as a whole. So again, for that reason, I can't imagine them going there. They could have 100 million people sign the petition, and I don't think Peter Jackson is going to make that change to the story. Not based on what we've seen in the first two films.
So, basically, then we've got A, B, C, and E. What would be some of the E? Did we talk about that?
I think E. So, actually, let me ask with the E people, because we do have several people who have voted E.
Right.
Of those of you who have voted E. What is swaying you towards E? Do you, those of you who are voting E, do you believe that Feely or Keely will survive? Is that part of your thinking? Because to me, that's the primary manifestation of E, right? Is if, like, Feely or Keely die, but other dwarves die. So, like, Feely lives, but Beaufort dies, for instance. You know, that would be an E answer, technically.
Well, we do have. I mean, C, Feely can live in C.
Right, but all the other dwarves have to live too. You know, C is the fewer total deaths answer.
That's right. So, that fell off. Yeah.
Now nobody has voted for C yet. You know, we're still sitting at zero on both C and D.
No one thinks people will live.
So everyone's very pessimistic about the life expectancy of dwarves in this film. Apparently, there's nobody taking a cheery view of this.
Andrew McLaughlin says he's going for Thorin, one of the Elies, and one or two of the other dwarves.
Okay, right. Yeah, so basically, if you think Feely or Keely is going to live, you think that's only going to happen if other dwarves die too.
Right.
So that we're still going to have at least the same net body count. Still a minimum of 3 total dwarf fatalities. Yeah. Yeah, Sarah Lagarde argues that that Jackson is still, like, still has a tinge of Ger Martin, and that we're going to increase the body count. Therefore, and she points out, you know, Jackson did kill off Haldir in the Battle of Helm's Deep. You know, so we do have the precedent of let's kill off another character who, you know, obviously wasn't killed off in the book, in order to. But see, my problem with the Haldir parallel is that Haldir's death, nobody else died in the Battle of Helm's Deep. I mean, lots of corpses, but no other named characters died in that battle. So in order to convey the loss, you know, in order to have grieving, other than just shots of extras grieving, over people. They can still do that. You know, like the very effective moment where we had the, you know, we showed the women and children huddling in the caves, right? Terrified. You can also get, you know, evocative pictures of, like, you know, a 12-year-old boy in armor crying over his, you know, weeping over the body of his father at the Battle of Helm's Deep. You can do that kind of thing. But it seemed like, you know, the killing off of a named character was clearly a move that they, you know, that sort of, you know, raised the profile of the grief and loss element of the battle. But, you know, we've got, you know, we start off by default with, you know, you get three deaths for free before you have to start paying for extras at the Battle of Five Armies, you know. So we've got plenty of grief and loss even before we really roll our sleeves up and get working here.
I think Rask kills off extras just so they can save on animation at the end.
Yeah.
Somebody here. Okay, so I'm trying to think who it is, says that they think Feely will live.
Yep.
But in which case, that would either be C or E.
C or
E. Assuming that person must have either not voted yet or voted E, because we still don't have any takers for C. I mean, if you think Feely's going to live, C would be no other dwarves die, which I think is totally feasible in Jackson's. I mean, like Haldir is a good example. He died. Nobody else really did that we knew of, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, basically, essentially, the fact that nobody has voted for C yet tells me nobody believes that Jackson is going to reduce the body count.
Right.
Yeah.
That there's going to be just an absolute reduction in the number of major deaths.
Because that would be only two dead, yeah. Right.
Yeah. That would be only one or two deaths.
Or, well, it's Feely and or Keely lives. Yeah, so, yeah. Oh, that's right. One so, or two, yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh. Let's think this through. I wonder what the... I don't know why. Like, my inclination here is to go with either A or B. Just sort of first blush, the way most of the live listeners are. But there is a part of me that feels like there's a pretty good chance that feels like they've set things up for Feely or Keely to live.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm in exactly the same boat you are.
Do you have arguments for Keely? I mean, I was Keely, making my argument that Keely is doomed for death. Do you think...
Yeah.
Do you see a reason to keep him alive?
It's Feely, really. That's where I'm at. Yeah, I think Keely's going to die. Whether Feely dies or not is...
Feely is our long-term, our best long-term investment here?
Yeah, I think Keely's set up for a tragic death just because... he's gotten too much character development time.
Yeah, exactly.
Not to mention the fact that he's got a mom who loves him and is worried about him. You know,
that's
so
right.
So he's almost.
Yeah, no, so Feely doesn't have a rock. I mean, come on, mom.
Yeah. Mom obviously has favorites.
The only thing is, I kind of feel like there is a reasonable narrative case to be made for either Keely or Tauriel surviving, at least. I guess there's a variation of this where one of them dies early and the other one dies a little bit later. But I feel like if they both die on screen in rapid succession, there's no time left for appropriate sort of for that death to sink in for the audience, for the characters to mourn the death on screen.
Yes.
And I feel like, Toriel's. I guess there's other characters that could mourn. You know, Legolas will certainly mourn Tauriel. Feely and other dwarves will certainly mourn Keely, but not in the same way that Tauriel will mourn Keely or Keely will mourn Tauriel. And so that's sort of the one kind of justification I could come up with Keely living. That sort of line of reasoning of like. Yeah. You know, like we need him. He needs some serious screen time to be really sad and upset that Toriel's dead.
Well, I mean, he could mourn her, but still, I mean, for a very short time, and then also die, right? I mean, we could still see him mourning her death, but then you know he ends up buying it. Now, I do have another option for Feely dying, which is actually pointing to the very same scene that Corey was talking about that would justify Feely living, which is in that same scene with Thorin. The reason he stays behind, in spite of being the heir, is to support his brother.
Yes.
I could see Feely dying on the battlefield as he's trying to protect Keely.
Self-sacrificially, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, I mean, that scene could set up either way, really.
Yep. Yep, I can definitely see. I mean, I can certainly see that. We're told in the book that Feely and Keely die defending their uncle. You know,
they
I mean,
that's right. They
so,
do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
I think Philip's suggestion is right, or is a good one. I think Keely or Toriel dying during the Smaug's attack
would be more convenient.
That leaves sufficient time for the death to sink in for the surviving character to mourn it, and then the other one bites it at the Battle of Five Armies.
Yeah. I think Toriel buys it at Lake Town, which turns Keely into a berserker. You know, and then he just goes into battle like crazy.
By the way, I think we have to, therefore, we have to throw, if one of these, if any of the dwarves die at Lake Town, the answer has to be E, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Because we're assuming all the dwarves would be there at Erebor.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
E would be.
All you people voting for B, you haven't thought it through.
That's right. Well, here's the other thing
and
that
I'm.
All
of a sudden, E starts going.
Here's the other thing that I'm thinking through with B. I'm inclined against B, and it's not because I think Peter Jackson is squeamish, but you know, as the ethos of his films has not been in the Ger Martin direction. That it hasn't been in the killing of major characters, bodies flying all over the place, but not major characters. They tend to instead remember the complaints that everybody had about how nobody was even injured, you know, when they plummeted in the bridge after killing the Goblin King down like, you know, 500 feet to the bottom, and then the Goblin King lands on them.
Yes.
If that were a George R. R. Martin novel, they would have all died.
They'd all be dead.
In that scene. But instead, we don't even have any of them injured. I mean, the impulse of these films has been all along to shield the major characters. So I don't believe myself that he's going to kill other major characters in a Rankin-Bass kind of way. That is, they were just thrown in for good measure in Rankin-Bass. Like, there was no reason given. It was not part of any kind of a narrative arc. It was just, oh, and by the way, you're never going to see these other dwarves again either. And I don't expect, just to increase the number of named corpses on the battlefield, we're going to get that. Now, my question then, though, becomes, are there any other dwarves for whom it makes narrative sense, or for whom it would be narratively satisfying for them to die on the battlefield?
Dwalin.
Dwalin is a possibility. Bofur is a possibility.
Bofur.
With the rest of them, I can't really see. I mean, like, if you kill off Nori or Ori, for instance, and I know that Ori is mentioned, you know, he's the one who writes the journal in Moria, but that's not in the film, so, you know, we don't have to be restricted to that. My suspicion, by the way, is that Ori's going to survive anyway, because he's like the doofus little kid of the party, and you know, killing him would be like stepping on a puppy, you know, so
yeah,
I don't think Peter Jackson would do that.
Nori could, I suppose.
Nori could die, but again, that would be a meaningless thing. You know, it wouldn't accomplish anything to have Nori die.
Yeah.
Bofur, we've invested enough in Bofur's character that his death
and
could
Dwalin
be
And Dwalin would be like a Klingon's death. You know, he'd go into battle.
Yes,
and kill,
he would die like a Viking.
50 orcs.
Absolutely,
yeah.
I could see Dwalin dying a Viking kind of death. But
Dwalin is well on his way to Stovokor.
He is. He is.
You know, the Klingon.
Yeah. So I mean, that I could see, but honestly, I don't
think they're going to kill Bofur.
You think they're going to kill Bofur? Why? Why do you think? Now again, they're making his character more significant, but why do you see death for him?
And more sympathetic.
Yeah. Because
just for there to be some additional pathos.
The message being the needless loss of war. The needless loss.
That's how I interpret the message in Rankin-Bass, of course. You know, sort of emphasize that as the depiction of the Battle of Five Armies.
I was just thinking, Peter Jackson messing with us.
Oh yeah, I see. Right, Peter Jackson messing with us. Well,
but
see,
again, it's what the move. It's the content, not the intent, right?
Right. I don't. Philip points out, I think Beaufort's death may have some meaning for Bilbo.
Right.
I agree, but I don't know. I mean, it's. I'm not saying I think it's impossible, but from everything we've seen of Beaufort's character, his doesn't seem like a trajectory that ends in death. It doesn't seem to be the direction his story's going. I don't know.
Oh, by the way, Kim Wehrmeister has pointed out, I mean, maybe Dwalin will be seriously injured, but apparently, based on what Graham McTavish has said in interviews, he's talked about how Thorin's death affects Dwalin. So
Dwalin goes berserk and
he may
dies after killing, 150 orcs in 35 seconds when Thorin dies. Yeah.
But we assume Thorin's going to probably die after the battle's over, right? So
yeah.
Dwalin might get injured, but it sounds
he could be, there for the mortal wounding of Thorin. He could be
one of
the people pulling Thorin off the battlefield. Again, Bjorn carries him off the battlefield in the book. I would expect one or more of the dwarves to carry him off the battlefield in the film.
So Corey, if I'm reading your reasoning correctly, you think that C is more likely than E.
Oh, that all the dwarves will live. Feliand or Keeley live, and all the dwarves live versus.
I think that C. I feel that C is more likely than B. When I ask myself, which direction do I feel like the arrow is pointing? Towards the preservation of named characters or the destruction of named characters in Peter Jackson's films as a whole and the way that they handle these? I would say it's pointed in the direction of the preservation of named characters. And that we have to go to Haldir in Helm's Deep to give an example of a named character that Jackson has gone out of his way to kill off. And he had to go out of his way to drag him into the story in order to get him killed off, right? I mean, that is to say, did he ever just kill a guy who was there in the book? That is just like alter the plot, Tolkien's plot, by killing off a character who in the book survives? Did that ever happen in the Lord of the Rings films? I don't remember it ever happening. I might be forgetting something. But
I've been trying to think. I've been thinking of
that. I don't think it does. I don't think he ever just killed off an extra character who in the book survives. So this is why I'm having a hard time believing in B. I could be convinced. I could be convinced that because of the particular, storyline trajectories of some of the other dwarf characters who had basically no trajectory of their own in the book. Characters like Beaufort is the obvious example of this. A character who's been given a kind of independent life and story in the film that he did not have at all in the book. Therefore, because he has been individualized in that way, that Jackson could decide that his story is going to culminate in death on the battlefield, whereas it didn't in the book. I could believe that. So I'm not like shouting down B as an impossibility in the same way that I would shout down D as I believe a functional impossibility. But I don't expect it. I'm not viscerally convinced by the arguments for the death of any of the other dwarves in the party other than the big three. That is the three who die in the book. I'm willing to believe it's possible, but I'm not convinced. And so for me, B is out, D is out. So for me, I'm thinking A, C, and E. And E, I'm skeptical of for the same reason, because again, he'd have to be choosing to kill off one of the other dwarves for what I would feel was a good reason. And since I haven't seen that reason enough to make me choose B, I'm not going to choose E either. So again, for me, the question is A or C.
You don't accept for good measure as a,
no, I don't accept reason. For good measure. Well, I mean, and again, and in saying that, I'm saying that not because, I guess here I'm breaking my own my own new policy of voting for awesome instead of likely. But my rationale for that is just simply my analysis of the other five films and saying what seems to be the trend, what kinds of stories are these, the kinds of stories, because it is, I get to briefly go back to our recurring sub theme of this entire episode, namely George R. R. Martin. The fact that George R. R. Martin so often kills off his major characters, it's not just a quantitative difference. It makes it a different kind of story, a fundamentally different kind of story that I experience very differently as a reader. That's why I don't accept For Good Measure. Because if you're going to kill off a bunch of named characters, you've made a serious choice. And this is what I dislike so much about the way they do it in the Rankin Bass, is that they do it, but they're wusses about it. Right? They just drop in a single line of dialogue, oh, FYI, these other dwarves also died. Oh, yeah, gosh, isn't that sad?
Yeah, right.
Like, they don't really push their chips to the center of the table, and, they make the choice, but they don't really follow it up. I think that's a wimp's way out.
What about the converse question that Jared Michael brings us up? Does he ever give reprieves to characters who die in the books?
Can we think of any examples of...
I haven't been able to think of anybody.
It is hard. Like, I feel like we're in kind of a unique situation here,
yeah,
where we have named characters in a film that we have come to be familiar with, that we care about, who are not sacrosanct. So, like, I feel like the Fellowship, apart, yes, from Gandalf, arguably, the Fellowship and Boromir, the Fellowship in The Lord of the Rings were sacrosanct.
Right.
Like, you could not kill any of them. Same thing with, like, characters like Éomer and Faramir. I guess maybe you could have seen them killing Faramir, maybe? I don't know. But, I feel like...
One could say they might as well have. But anyway, sorry. But anyhow,
but,
sorry.
But I think we're in a unique situation here where there are characters both who died that we can imagine him allowing to live, and it would sort of make sense and not destroy the story, or characters who live that he could theoretically kill. Maybe he has no reason to do so, but doing so wouldn't destroy the story.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree. And I've been thinking, and I can't think of the converse question that Gerald was asking. I can't think of anybody who dies in the book that stays alive in the film. It's really... by the way, I did think of another named character whom Jackson kills off in The Lord of the Rings and who lives in the book. The Mouth of Sauron.
Aha! Uh-huh.
That's not really a major example. But there you go! That was an extra death. He lives in the book. But that's how far we have to go. Azog got a reprieve, right? Exactly. Azog, there you go. Azog lived. There you go.
Well, there you go. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, Azog. Of course, we're overlooking the obvious. Azog, who dies in the book,
but
he lives in the film. Absolutely. There you go. QED. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't. I can't think of anybody else. But I agree with you, Dave, that we can't just simply point to that precedent and say, well, so haven't we just pretty much proven that the answer is A, right? That, that in fact the track record over five films is that Peter Jackson has in fact, when it comes to death toll and the death of named characters, stuck almost exactly to the books in both directions.
Yeah. Yep.
But I don't think, for exactly the reasons that you argued. Yeah.
Yeah, going strictly by precedent, the only really acceptable answers are A and C.
Yeah, exactly. Strictly by precedent. But I'm being very strongly influenced by precedent here, again, primarily in thinking about it in the terms that I was trying to explain, thinking about the nature of the story, sort of the quality of the story. And I have a hard time thinking he's just going to suddenly flip a switch and become George R.R. Martin in film three, when he hasn't ever been that in any of the rest of the stories. And because it would be a story shift, and I don't anticipate that kind of shift, so I don't believe in it. And I certainly don't think it would be awesome, so I'm not voting for it on either ground. I'm going C.
You're going C?
I'm going C. And the reason I'm going C, the reason I am in the end going to choose C over B, or over A, rather, is that I don't think it's going to be squeamishness, but I think it's going to be... I think that Dan is too peripheral a character. I think that the storyline of the restoration of the Kingdom of Erebor has been too central to this film. And that having this random dude who just came out of nowhere, right, and it's like, oh, and by the way, he's distantly related to Thorin. Let's make him king under the mountain at the end, and then call that a happy ending and say, see, look, hooray, the Kingdom of the Dwarves is recovered. That'll be technically true, but I don't think it's really going to hit home. In order to have a restored kingdom...
Especially given what we've heard about him, where it sounds like they're going to make him a somewhat farcical character.
Right. Right. Or at least...
I think you're right. And they've set Feely up as like a noble character who makes the right decisions.
Yeah. See. Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, the self-sacrificial role could go to Tariel as far as Keely dying.
Yep.
You know, she could die sacrificing for him, so Feely... Yeah. I mean, I could definitely see Jackson keeping Feely alive and having him become king.
Yeah, that would be my official prediction. I mean, I already predicted that Keely is doomed. So yeah, I think it's going to be Keely and Thorin, and Feely is going to survive.
So in my case, if I subscribe to that, then it's either C or E. E being if other dwarves die.
Right. If you think Beaufort's also going to buy it or something like that. So by the way, my sort of meta prediction here is that I know it's not exactly a meta prediction. It's like a down the road prediction. I also predict that the survival of Feely is going to be one of the primary things that I'm going to be giving lectures about next year, trying to explain why I don't think it's a horrible, terrible deviation from the book for him to do, and everybody else saying, see, look, he's ripping Tolkien to shreds. He left Feely alive, and Tolkien's rolling over in his grave. So that's going to be... Feely's survival is going to be my Keely and Toriel relationship thing for next year. That's my free bonus prediction there.
Yeah, sorry. I did want to ask, like, is that something do you think will infuriate people?
Yes. Absolutely.
I agree. It doesn't infuriate me, though.
My prediction of the infuriation of people is much more confident than my prediction of that actually occurring. But I'm confident that if it occurs, it's going to infuriate people. I feel very confident of that.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, people's reactions to that are completely predictable. We know exactly.
I really think so. I really do think so. Maybe, you know, who knows?
Right.
Maybe
I'm saying C as well.
You're saying C as well. All right.
Yep. I was leaning in that direction all along.
Yeah.
I really think they're going to leave one of those two guys alive. I think you're right. I think the restoration of the Kingdom of Erebor story and the return of the kingship to the line of Durin is much stronger if it goes to one of those two than if it goes to random character that hasn't been in either of the other films.
Yeah.
And they've
made
such a point of it, I think, in the movies. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Feely being the heir.
Yes. And Dan has been so off the map.
Peripheral.
I mean, the only thing we've gotten is that they like, basically, he's going to be like the dude who wouldn't help them at the beginning and is now helping them for some reason because he saw the, you know, like they sent up the Arkenstone bat signal and he came. Again, that's fine and everything. But yeah, I don't see that. My
thinking in that regard is how much Billy Connolly's irritated me with regard to his role in this movie.
I don't want that guy to be king.
My, And, well, my thought is, who knows? Maybe he irritated Jackson so much that Jackson just rewrote it.
That's right. Forget it. Forget it. I'm taking away your kingship. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm actually thinking this, too. I mean, again, we've been so woefully wrong in the past, you know, that I always want to second think my thoughts here. But I do think that it does make sense if Feely would live. Then my question is it C or E? You know, my question is whether the dwarves die.
Indeed, I would argue, I think E is more likely than A or B.
Yeah.
I am so sure that one of Keeley or Feely will die that I think it's more likely that other dwarves will also die than it is that he will...
That both of them will die.
And Keeley.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I'm hung up is, you know, do all the dwarves live? And I think, you know, your argument is good in that he's not just killed to kill in the past. Mm-hmm. If anything, like you said in the Goblin King's deal, you know, I mean, they all live. Of course, that being part of the story where they all needed to get to the Lonely Mountain. So he made sure they all still lived.
No, they didn't. We could have done without any number of them. We could have lost Nori back we could have lost. I mean, seriously, Bifur's got an axe in his head. What good is he doing to anybody? You know,
I don't think Philippa would let him do that. Though.
No, I don't think so either. But the point is, it could have happened. I mean, there are so many things. This is one of the reasons to some extent, people's purist objections to the Hobbit films kind of set off my justice meter. Like, I feel people are being unjust because there are so many. If he were just tearing the book to shreds and not caring about the book, many purists depict, there are so many things he could have done worse. He gave us all 13 dwarves in the first place. He could have been like, that's way too many dwarves. Most directors would have said that was way too many dwarves and said, let's just make it a more efficient party of like 5 and give them each a really important role. He didn't do that. He could have been doing this. We could have been having dead dwarves, you know, in a trail leading all along the way. We had extras. You know, we had red shirts in the party if we needed them. Bifur, has he done anything? You know, again, Nori, he's been an essential non-entity. Ori already delivered his prophetic speech in Bag End. He's done now. We can get rid of him.
We don't really need Dori to be the fussy older brother.
No. Ori's cute, but superfluous. You know, so yeah, I mean, there's no reason we couldn't have been whittling down the company to this point. Absolutely,
okay,
it could
me.
Have happened.
I'm going with C2. So that makes Kurt,
well,
Schreier, and the three of us.
That's right.
Well, if there's one thing you can be sure of now, folks, it's that C is not the right answer.
Exactly right.
That's
if we all
right.
three
so
of
Kurt,
us agree on something,
Kurt
especially
is
if we're
celebrating now, but Kurt, you're going to be sorry.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
I would like to know what Brianna thinks. What do you think, Brianna?
Yeah, Bri, what was your vote? Let's get down to like serious business. Yep, Yana
she
was.
She says Feely and Keeley's death is partially Thorin's fault, so him losing his kingship and his line is sort of the point.
Yeah, so she's been A from the beginning.
So she's A,
yeah.
She's
fair enough, but that's not the story they're telling in the films.
Yep. Yep. I like it. I like the C story. I think it could work really well. That is, I like how it fits with the story they've been telling so far. Yep. No, I'm happy with this.
Well, my thing says 81% voted. Does yours say 81%?
Yeah, that's right. That's good. Yeah, let's close.
Anybody
it.
Anybody else go in here?
I got to go here in a minute. So.
Okay, so here we go. Oh, share. I forgot I have to share it. There we go.
Okay.
So we've got 52
A predominates. I'm delighted to say 0% have voted for D. Nobody thinks Thorin's going to live.
Yes, thank God. You guys have learned from us well.
Yes. Yes.
Well, somebody may think he lives, but they damned if they were going to say it, right?
we've been like kicking dirt in the faces of everybody who wants Thorin to live for weeks now.
That may be the rest of the people that didn't vote.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, we've been bullying and intimidating the pro Thorin's living party.
Corey, here's the real question: if Thorin somehow lives, will you end your relentless defense of the films and join the purist bandwagon of he's destroyed them?
I'm never going to join the purist bandwagon, but will I like that, no. I think the odds of me being ready cheerfully to defend the survival of Thorin, if it happens, are about 2%.
Your justice reflex will not kick in on that one.
No,
sure.
It will not kick in on that one. No. I mean, again, I'm giving it 2%. I'm not saying 0% because I've not seen the film, and perhaps maybe, you know, there's like a way that they could tell that story that would be satisfying in a way that I don't currently anticipate. And, you know, that he has a thing in mind that I'm not seeing. I always want to hold out the possibility for that. And that I would, you know, be converted to this storyline during the film. But I think there is no more than a 2% chance of that occurring if that's the way it goes. So, yes, I would not. I'm already kind of composing in my head my defenses for Fili's survival. I am not preparing defenses for Thorin's survival. Yeah. You know what I think I should do? I think I should do just like they do. You know how if you're a sports fan, if you follow the NFL, you know how NFL teams always create draft press releases prior to doing their picks. So they don't know which pick they do, but they obviously have press releases written for like any one of 15 players that they might pick in the first round, because the instant the pick is announced, their press release is out, and you know it's obviously been no time to do it. I think I'm going to do the same thing. I think I'm going to pre-record before I see the film. I'll pre-record a podcast episode in which I defend the survival of Fili. So as soon as I see the film, if it happens, I'll just release it, you know, so that people can have my response before, like when they come home from the theater, they'll have my podcast episode defending it, you know, already there, you know, on their feed. And I think that's what I'm going to do. And then if he doesn't die, or if he does die, I just won't release it, you know, just like all those other press releases that the teams presumably wrote for the players they didn't draft, just get thrown in the hopper. So yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, you've just wasted a perfectly good 2 hours listening to the Riddles in the Dark. That's my car talk ending.
That's right. I prefer to think of it as an investment of time rather than a wasting of time.
No, and I'm totally tongue in cheek. Now we are a little. We do need to do a little bit of powwowing, the three of us, about when the next episode is actually going to happen, if it is going to be in 2 weeks, because I know Dave is going to be either en route or at San Diego at that point.
Yes.
Yeah.
So stay tuned, everybody.
I should have, just to give you a preview, in case the listeners are interested too, I'm going to Comic-Con. I haven't finalized my travel plans. I'm either going down Thursday night or Friday morning. I'm going to attend the con for part of Friday, and then as soon as I see a line for Hall H forming, I'm getting in it, and then I will stay in it until the panel at 10 a.m. on Saturday. So
okay.
I'm committed to spending the night.
Good. So.
Hopefully we will be. Okay.
I was just going to say quickly, any listeners, listeners who are listening to this recording, who are planning to go to San Diego Comic-Con, you should reach out to Dave so that we can, mm-hmm. so he can have as much support here as possible.
Sure.
So reach him at Twitter at Dave Kale, DaveKale, and
you can always get him on the Riddles and Dark page too.
Yeah,
let him know
you're
coming.
Email me kale@mythgard.org.
Yeah, kale@mythgard.org too. Yeah, is
now,
email address.
I do think hopefully we will be able to do our Thorin episode 2 weeks from today.
Yeah,
you know, hopefully you'll be in your hotel room or whatever, and can, you know, we can just do that. And then what we also want to powwow about is doing a special Comic-Con episode just about your experience of Comic-Con. Hopefully, maybe that Monday or whenever will work for you. So we just need to figure out with you, Dave, and Kim. Obviously, can join us for that.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah. Any podcast listeners who are there, we'd totally like to have you like be a live panel
join
on the
us.
Next show. Yeah.
Yeah, come and be on that for that special bonus Comic-Con show. So anyway, we'll figure that out. But hopefully, we'll be able to have the already scheduled one in 2 weeks happen on schedule, and then we'll let you know about the bonus one.
Yeah,
when we figure out Dave's schedule and when he'll be awake and stuff.
Yeah, cool.
Anything else? We have Mythmoot, right?
Mythmoot, yes. The call for papers
call
has gone out for Mythmoot.
We've been receiving a steady stream of proposals. And please, I hope anybody who wants to, this is a great venue if you've never presented before but have been wanting to. This is a perfect place to do that. And just send it into proposals at mythgard.org, and you'll get put in the list and hopefully be presenting at MythBoot.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, definitely. That's been a big thing. We have our fall classes for Mythgard coming out soon. They should be released next week.
Very exciting ones, too.
Yeah, there should be some really good stuff. One little preview I can give. I'm teaching my Lewis and Tolkien class again. I taught it almost 3 years ago at Mythgard. And we'll be doing some close reading and comparison of C.S. Lewis's fiction and Tolkien's fiction. Those are two writers who obviously knew each other and agreed about a lot of things and hung out a lot. But people often tend to kind of lump their stuff together. And I think that it's kind of unusual, actually, for people to really sit down and do a close comparison of the two. So that's what we're going to be doing in the class, is sort of looking at ways in which they address when they're doing similar things or addressing similar questions or issues, to sort of look at how they do it.
And I'm an alumna of that course, and I've got to tell you, first of all, are you going to include Glyer's book? I mean, about the Inklings too.
Actually, I'm going to recommend it, though we're not going to do a session on it this time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But I must say, the inter-student discussion board in these courses is always active, but I don't think that I've been in as active a discussion board as the Tolkien Lewis course.
Huh. Yeah.
There was a lot of really excellent debate, discussion, conversation that went on as an adjunct to the main, lectures that auditors and, MA enrollees can participate in. So that's a really good course. And if you wanted to, I didn't know much about Lewis going in, and I'm really glad I took the course because it really helped me a lot to sort of understand Lewis much, much, much better. So now I can, when I make an opinion about Lewis, I actually have something to fall back on.
Right. And I'm always excited about this class because it's the only class I teach in which I get to teach till we have faces, which is
I love that book.
Brilliant,
so
brilliant book. One of the greatest books C.S. Lewis wrote.
Which really isn't well known, is it?
No, it gets very little press.
Heard anybody bring that
even Lewis fans. I mean, I've got, I know a lot of people who love C.S. Lewis, but who haven't read Till We Have Faces. So anyway, yeah, that's
I mean, and I, I now can say that I'm not as much of a fan of Lewis's fiction as I am of Tolkien's fiction. I'm more a fan of Lewis's nonfiction than of Tolkien's nonfiction, with that exception. Mm-hmm. Till We Have Faces is just an awesome fiction.
Till We Have Faces is excellent. Yeah, I don't. Alden, I do. I don't do the whole space trilogy. C.S. Lewis's space trilogy. We do Perelandra, because in particular, that's the moment when I'm looking at the way that both of them treat the idea of the fall. So looking at sort of Tolkien's fall stories and Lewis's Perelandra, and looking at the way they both talk about that, because it's a significant issue in both of their fiction.
By the way, Till We Have Faces, I characterized as someone as, within the context of Tolkien and Lewis's lives, fan fiction.
Yeah, exactly. It's like myth fan fiction.
Greek mythology fan fiction.
Yeah. Apuleius fan fiction. That's basically what
it is.
That's, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. In the same sense in which, Virgil was Homer fan fiction. That's
right. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. That's right. Now, Mythgard Academy, Dune is coming up soon, isn't it?
The Dune class. So we have one more week of the Book of Lost Tales, and I should make a special plug for that, the finely dressed Andrew Higgins is going to be joining me. So we have a special guest in our last Book of Lost Tales class, Riddles in the Dark regular Andrew Higgins, who is writing his dissertation on Tolkien's early work, and in particular his early languages, is going to be joining me for a discussion of Tolkien's languages, the sort of names and languages in the Book of Lost Tales. We're going to be doing sort of an overview of the development of Tolkien's languages, so Andrew can kind of fill us in on kind of the history of the language development and how that language development was connected to the Book of Lost Tales, and then we'll look at some of the ways in which Tolkien's work on the languages, really sort of influenced the Lost Tales that we've been discussing. So it's going to be really fun. And we're not doing it. That's why Sarah says, is Andrew Higgins going to be live in the middle of the night? No, we're going to have to hold it in the afternoon Eastern time instead of evening Eastern time next week for exactly that reason. I don't want to make Andrew talk about it. I'm sure he would get up to talk about Tolkien's early languages at 2:30 in the morning, but I don't want to compel him to do that. So So we'll be doing so that's the grand finale of the Book of Lost Tales class this coming week, and then we're going to take 1 week off, and then shifting to a new night Wednesday nights, starting Wednesday night, July 30th. We will be starting Frank Herbert's Dune, and we're going to be spending a while on that. We've got 12 weeks on Dune because there's a lot to talk about.
There's so much to talk about.
Yeah.
Well, this has been fun. You know, I mean, I'm not going to do it, but I'm almost tempted to take our genre discussion in this out into another bonus episode.
You know, I was thinking that too, especially since a lot of people have been prompting me or perhaps trying to provoke me into talking more about George R.R. Martin.
I'll tell you what I'll do. Instead of doing that, just because, you know, I want to get the podcast out, and if I have to do all that editing, it may take me longer, I'll give the minute marker
I
post the thing. I'll say, okay, at minute such and such to minute such and such, there's this great conversation of genre. So if people just want to listen to that part, they can.
right. Yeah. No, I think that's a good compromise.
That's my compromise.
I think we need to get Ger Martin to come to Myth Moot.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. That would be... I mean, well, we certainly would increase the attendance.
Yes, we would. And... and the controversy, you know, that way, Martin and I could just do like fisticuffs if all else fails.
The Battle of the Titans.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That would be, Kurt predicts the Red Wedding would break out at Myth Moot. That happened. Yeah.
Good point. Don't bring him.
yeah.
I am going to, I'll tell you what though, if I run into, I heard Jim Butcher is going to be at Comic-Con and I'm making it one of my other mission is to find him. If I run into him, I'm going to tell him to come.
A gentle,
I have nagged Corey every year.
A gentle guilt trip would be good. No, I've actually been very close to getting Jim Butcher before, but he had to cancel. Last time he had to cancel, I think because he was finishing Skin Game.
That was for a Tolkien show.
Yeah, I was going to do a Tolkien chat with him, and I was like scheduled and everything. I was actually on the cusp of announcing it because we were going to do a live chat thing. And like right before I was about to tweet that it was going to be happening, you know, in the following week, I got an email that said that like he had to cancel all of his appointments because like the publishers were getting on him about his deadline. So, I've been close with Butcher before. You know, I like him and that could happen. I hope it does.
Yeah. So if you see him, Dave, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'll work on it.
All right.
I think you should also try to get John Hodgman.
John Hodgman?
Yeah.
Yeah, you had a reason for that. I forget what your reason. There was a reason
He's a closet Tolkien fan, man.
Oh, is he?
Right.
Oh.
And a giant nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a giant nerd. He'd be great to have. I'd love to have him. He's so funny.
That would be fun.
Oh, of course, and then of course, there's also always Stephen Colbert, of course, since he's not anywhere near a big star.
Exactly. Yeah.
Although we might be able to get what's his name, the actor James Franco. It's like, look, you couldn't beat Colbert. Come to Myth Moot and see if you can win the trivia game.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that would be funny. Yeah, that would be. It'd be a little bit hard to take that seriously. I mean, like for me to take that seriously. How could we have him and yet like not make fun of him
he was there? It's true.
You know,
which would be really the sad thing for us to do to our VIP guests.
It sure would. Yeah. Well, anyway, we're open to suggestions. If people have guests they would like to see, of course, most of these ideas are not plausible or not realistic. But there I go using
the
word
realistic. But shoot for the stars and you may make it to the moon. So I say, let us know if you've got any outlandish ideas.
Exactly.
We're working on the agenda right now. So,
this is the
right time.
We're finalizing that. All right. I got to run. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
See you guys later. Oh, excuse, I should say, of course.
That's
thanks
right.
for listening and Godspeed.